in spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first Living Room Times podcast. This, fittingly, we start with Becky bossing me around. This is Brendan, and...
Hi, I'm Becky.
This is Becky, and we are the co-hosts of this Living Room Times, a.k.a. Brendan and Becky podcast. This initial episode is probably going to be a little bit free-form because we've never done this before, and we're going to be trying to figure it out as we go. But I do have the first official Living Room Times podcast sound effect, which is me opening a beer.
I'll have you all know it's a Bud Light because he's classy like that.
Oh, I was going to mention that. But the best part is that it's a Bud Light that I'm pouring into a Waterford crystal.
Oh, it's not Waterford. It is Tiffany's.
Oh, Tiffany. Crystal. Tiffany's crystal beer stein. So it's super, super classy.
It was a wedding present.
Yeah. So anyway, although this is the Living Room Times podcast, in the interest of full disclosure, we should say that we're actually sitting at the dining room table. So, you know, the lawsuits can come flying in. For those three or four of you who are listening to this, we're going to be...
Hi, Mom.
Hi, random Twitter people. Hi, Brandon and Melissa. We're going to be trying to sort of come up with some regular features as we go forward with this, and we're very much open to suggestions on that. But one feature that I thought would be fun is just kind of to start out with a review of the week that was. And rather than calling it Review of the Week That Was, we figured we would take some inspiration, or I figured anyway, that we could take some inspiration from our children's favorite TV show and call this segment...
What Was Your Favorite Part?
In which we discuss our favorite part of the week that was. You want to go first?
Totally want you to go first.
All right, so I would say that my favorite part of the week that was the delicious tomatillo salsa that Becky made, which she just cruelly removed from... the table before I had a chance to eat any of it, because she says that we can't be eating nacho chips during our podcast, which is probably a wise assessment, but it's still kind of mean. But I believe that salsa first debuted last week, so I can't go with that. And in the absence of being able to do that, by the way, the tomatillos are grown fresh in our garden.
Organic, thank you.
Yeah. In the absence of that, I think I'm going to totally veer away from being remotely romantic or schmoopy or anything that has to do with Becky, and instead annoy her by going with my favorite thing being the acquisition of my Mac Mini, and go just total geek on this one. So earlier in the week, I bought a dual Core 2 Duo. I think that's repetitive, but there's a couple duos in there. 2.0 gigahertz Mac Mini to serve as kind of our multimedia ESPN 3 watching and so forth station, and also our backup server and our iPhoto.
Is anyone as bored as I am right now by this?
Yeah. So anyway, I also have an app on my iPhone where I can control what's on the computer, which displays on our TV screen from the iPhone, and I can zoom in and out, and it's freaking awesome, and I love it, and yeah, it's great. So I'm really excited about that.
Well, my favorite part of the week, to veer back into the domestic sphere, is... that we have a neurotic foster greyhound. We foster greyhounds for the Colorado Greyhound Adoption because that's our way of doing something good in the world, and it's free. So we take in the hounds, and they hang out with us, and then we adopt them out to other families. And our greyhound this time around has developed a pathological terror of our hardwood floor. Now, if you've ever been over to our house, you know that our entire main floor is a gorgeous hardwood that the previous owners paid a lot of money to install. So the dog will not walk on the main floor of our house, which is kind of a problem for her coming down the stairs, going out to use the bathroom, eating her food, and all other manner of dog necessities. So Brendan has taken to having to carry the dog from the bottom step out the back door, which
is not like a Jack Russell Terrier, mind you.
Yeah, the greyhound is like a 65-pound giant dog. I mean, it's kind of like carrying a Great Dane. You're like, it looks ridiculous.
Especially because, like, you know, I'm not exactly some sort of muscle man here.
No. So my nerdy husband gets to carry our foster dog around. I think that he has never been so happy as when I told him that the foster dog is getting spayed this week and moving on out to her new and hopefully permanent family.
Yeah, you know, a couple days ago I noticed that my back was hurting a little bit, and I thought, that's odd. I wonder why I have this, you know, mild soreness in my back. And then I just realized yesterday that it's probably from lifting the dog, and I'm sure I'm lifting the dog up wrong, although I don't know how you correctly lift a greyhound. I'm not sure if there's a manual for that, but undoubtedly I'm doing it wrong, and so I'm going to throw out my back trying to lift this freaking dog to get it to go outside, so it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So before we get into the actual topics that we're going to discuss today, that we've sort of talked about a little bit in advance, another sort of gimmicky weekly feature that I thought might be fun.
Oh, can we do this at the end?
No, we should do the beginning.
No, we should totally do it at the end. It's so an end thing.
But at the end, we were going to talk about, like, looking ahead to next week.
Were we?
Well, I just thought of that, like, a half hour ago.
Well, can't we do that at the end after we do this thing?
This is the first official Living Room Times podcast bickering. There will be many more. All right, fine. We can jump into the topics. I think the subtitle on this episode of the podcast might be in which Brendan and Becky try to remember not to say their children's names out loud, because one of these topics that we're going to discuss is going to touch heavily on parenting. And we never talk about our kids as Loyette and Loyacita. We just don't refer to them that way in conversation ever. And so if you hear from this point forward, if you hear any beep in the audio, it's because I went back at post-processing and you know, got rid of the part where we accidentally said our kids' names. So
we kind of have two topics we want to cover today, both tangentially at least related to parenting. But the first one is one that's been getting a lot of play in the media, and that is the rash of suicides by gay teenagers, and particularly this kid at, I guess he was at Rutgers, Tyler Clementi, who jumped off a bridge after his douchebag of a roommate kind of American pied him and put his sexual escapades on the internet for his peers viewing. I don't guess that would be pleasure. I don't really know. And there's sort of been a subcropping of issues coming out of this. And one of the things that has struck me about the reporting on this issue is that it's really been taken to a place of clearly this kid killed himself because he was gay and because his exploit was gay sex. And I don't think that that necessarily follows. I've been kind of troubled by that assumption that, well, if he's gay, of course he's suicidal and male-adjusted. Because frankly, I think that anybody who commits suicide 5 weeks into a school year probably has some pre-existing issues unrelated to having a dick for a roommate. And certainly, like, it's a horrible tragedy to lose anyone at that point in their lives because they're just starting to get interesting. But honestly, you know, when you're 19, you're starting your life. You're on your way to adulthood. So, I mean, you know, you're not some pissant 14-year-old who thinks they have an idea. You're actually becoming an adult who is a legitimate producer of I don't know, thoughts in the world.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I think that I've seen a lot of, kind of rallying the pitchforks among a lot of my gay friends and a lot of my straight friends too, frankly. And I'm not sure I'm ready to quite you know, put these two jerks out to pasture for 5 years in a prison because they put their roommates kissing some guy online. Frankly, I mean, I don't know. I just don't think the prank is worth it. I think the tragedy it's horrible enough that the kid killed himself that these kids have to live with that for the rest of their lives. I'm not sure they have to go to jail.
Yeah, I think there's two separate issues. Well, there's a whole bunch of separate issues, but there's two separate issues about the gay angle. One is the question of, did he kill himself in substantial part because he was this tortured gay person whose identity as being gay, that aspect of identity was revealed when he didn't want it to be to the public at large, and he that pushed him over the edge. And I frankly just have no idea, because I don't know. The troubling thing, I suppose, is neither does anyone else really, and everyone's, you know, maybe people are assuming that.
Yeah, that's what's bothering me, right. Is that jump. It's right. Like, oh, you assume, well, of course, because he's gay, he's right. Unhappy. Like, there are no happy,
well, I don't think that's,
18-year-old gay kids.
Yeah, but I don't think that's, I mean, obviously he killed himself, so obviously
he was
unhappy.
Yeah.
So we can make that assumption. And then from that, it's not a huge leap, I don't think, to recognize the fact that there is a disproportionate, I think, I mean, I haven't read scientific literature on this, but it's my understanding that there are a lot of cases of depression and suicide among particularly like closeted gay people or young gay people in circumstances where they really, you know, like, you know, like in Utah or whatever, where it's, you know, it's
he's
tough.
Not in Utah. No, he's in New Jersey. I mean, I don't know.
Right. But
are New Jersey's that big of homophobes?
Well, there's homophobes everywhere. But I mean, the point is, I guess it stands to reason at some level that if you were in the closet and then your homosexuality was revealed in such a crude and public and humiliating way, that would make it all the more traumatizing, you know, as opposed to the hypothetical situation that would be traumatizing enough, where you're, you know, a freshman in college and you're hooking up with some girl, you're a straight guy and you're hooking up with some girl, or let's make it the girl who's hooking up with a guy, because maybe that's stereotypically more traumatizing. I don't know. But, you know, so let's say you're a girl and you're hooking up with some guy and someone gets it on a webcam and all of a sudden you're a slut and everyone on campus is like, oh, you're the slut. Okay, that sucks. And that could potentially cause someone to have a depressive episode. It could potentially push someone over the edge. But I think it's not a huge leap to say that it's maybe less traumatic for the average person who's going through that awful situation than add on to all of that, in addition to that, the fact that, oh, by the way, now everyone knows you're gay, which maybe you were trying to keep secret. So I think it's an additional level of horror and awfulness. So I can understand that. I think it's debatable, and I do think you're right that people are probably assuming too much. But there's a separate question that I think is a little bit more...
Okay, so I got to interrupt here. See, this is... I'm sorry, but I'm like, this is my... Maybe this is my, like, liberal and pie-in-the-sky notions. But I'm like, I just think it's so sad that you would say that. But like, you know, you want to hide that you're gay. Like, I just...
Well, so, but I mean, people do.
People do. I know. And I just think that that's such a tragedy that people feel the need to hide that.
Yeah, well,
and,
of course.
And I'm just, it goes without saying, but like, I sometimes I feel like, you know, it's almost a shame that you don't have like a spot on your face or something if you're gay. But everybody just knows, you know, because like, honestly, it's like trying to hide your a part of your identity that's just there.
Right.
And you know, you can't hide that you're like, I'm a white girl.
Right.
Like I can't hide the fact that I have like bright blue eyes and light skin. Like that's obvious.
Right.
If I walk into like South Central, I am, oh, look, there goes the white girl, you know? And in some ways that's liberating because everybody already knows that I'm white and I don't have to like, there's no conversation to be had about it.
Ah, white girl liberation. It's a profound movement.
I know. But no, but you know what I'm saying?
I understand.
Like, you know, you almost wish that there was some sort of identifying marker so you could be like, you know, dude, that's, you know, whatever.
The yellow triangle.
I don't know. It's just frustrating.
I understand what you mean. But then the other point I think is, that by the way, that's 12 minutes into the first Living Room Times podcast, we had our first Nazi reference. So
yeah,
that's
I didn't
good.
Make it, so.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. Anyway, you're a Nazi. The other point that I was going to make is that there's another question, and I think this really goes to perhaps some of what you're seeing from people who are all outraged and whatnot. And I mean, it is outrageous, but... was it a hate crime? Was it targeted against him because he was gay? I see no reason to believe that unless you know, there's something that I don't know about this case that hasn't been revealed. But like the tweet that the asshole roommate posted was, you know, just like, oh, look, he's making out with a dude. Ha ha. You know, whatever. And that's just typical asshole-ish behavior. And this is one of the things that my first reaction when I read about this story was actually, you know, of course you automatically, without even having to say it out loud, you feel awful for the family of the kid who killed himself, you know, family and friends, and everyone is directly affected by that. But one of the, you know, aside from that, almost simultaneous to that, I felt awful for the kids who did it, who you know, caused this thing to happen, putting this online. Because those people have to, because all those people are, in the absence of any other information, I have to assume that all they are is just typical asshole 19-year-olds or 18-year-olds or whatever. They're just... I mean, they're the type of people that I wouldn't have associated with in college if I knew they were doing something like that, because it's a really, really terrible thing to do to someone. It's awful. And I don't want to demean it at all. It's awful whether the kid's gay, straight, man, woman, it doesn't matter. It's terrible to invade someone's privacy like that. Even if the person hadn't killed himself, it's still a terrible, terrible thing to have done. Having said that, there are an awful lot of 19-year-old or 18-year-old assholes who do stuff in the same sort of general asshole category as that, who don't have the consequence that someone dies and they have to live with that for the rest of their life.
Well, because honestly, though, I mean, I think that is what this is really about. Nobody sets up like a webcam of their roommate doing something stupid, you know, like making out with a guy, girl, whoever.
Right.
And expects like they're going to die.
Right.
I mean, that's just complete, like that. That doesn't follow. Of course, they're not being charged for murder or something
right.
like that. You know,
but of course, all the outrage about them is based. I mean, if this had happened and the kid hadn't killed himself, no one, it wouldn't be a national story. It would probably be in the Rutgers student paper, and that would be it. You know, and so I think that the fact that they have to bear that additional consequence is really
like their pictures were in the New York Times.
Right.
I mean, this is a pretty dramatic consequence.
Right, and it's just it's not something. They don't deserve sympathy for what they did because what they did was just
awful.
Really awful.
Yeah,
but at the same time. They don't deserve all the outrage that goes with, like, you killed someone. Because although they did do something that led to push someone over a breaking point and led to their death, and although it is, I mean, arguably, if you invade someone's privacy like that, you're messing with their whole life, and that can happen. I mean, it's not like unbelievable that you might push someone over the edge that way, but it's just also, it's so far beyond the normal experience of what you would expect to happen when you pull an asshole stunt like that, that I think that there has to be some level of actual compassion for those people, and that whatever punishment they get, and this is easy to say and impossible to do, but whatever punishment they get should be the punishment they would have gotten if the kid hadn't killed himself. Because the fact that he killed himself isn't the fact that they happened to pick the one kid out of 1,000 who they could have done this to, who was so close to the edge anyway that he was going to go kill himself, doesn't make what they did any more or less morally repugnant. It's morally repugnant on its own based on what they did, invading someone's privacy in that way. And the consequence should be exactly the same as if the person had just been pissed off and then moved on 2 days later.
Now, segueing this into, you know, a further discussion of this phenomenon, though, there have been a lot of cases of gay teens committing suicide. And I think that this is not necessarily is something that's exclusive to the gay community. There are a lot of suicides among teenagers. And I think it's something that, as a society, we need to pay a little bit more attention to. Not only that kids are being bullied because they're gay, but just that kids are being bullied left and right everywhere. In high school, there, you know, there seems to be this I don't know, meme in our society that it's okay to make fun of people or to sort of torture the fat kid or to, you know, I was referencing in the car to Brendan a case where some member of an audience was yelling at an NFL player, and heaven knows what he's yelling, but there's this idea that we can heckle people to our heart's content and that's okay. And I wonder, you know, if that kind of attitude that we have about that is about that in terms of, you know, our sports stars or our president or whoever, that this is trickling down to our kids in terms of a casual meanness that is really impacting their lives in a profound way, such that, you know, these kids who are depressive anyway are just getting, I don't know, bullied and heckled to death.
You know, it's actually interesting because I can think of an example that ties these two things together, the sports example you just gave. A couple years ago, there was a basketball player for Cal who was someone like tricked him into, they were pretending that they were like a co-ed and they wanted his cell phone number or something. And it was like Stanford, I think it was like Stanford fans were trying to like get the Cal basketball player something. I may be getting the facts of this all screwed up, but it was something along these lines. And so the fans like got his, maybe it was Cal fans who knew a USC player. Maybe that's why I even know about it. That's what it was. It was a USC player.
Goodness.
So the Cal fans got this guy's, got this guy's phone number and pretending to, you know, like that he wanted to like hook up with this girl, this mythical girl. So then at the game in Berkeley, all the fans are like chanting his cell phone number at him, and they're like have all these signs, they're like repeating like things that he said by I am to the supposed girl or whatever. And I mean, like, it was really freaking funny, first of all. Like, it just was. It was hilarious. But at the same time, like, what if that basketball player had been like seriously depressed and this was so humiliating him that he went and killed himself? Would that mean that these people who invaded his privacy in that way would be like awful people? Well, no. I mean, it was kind of a jackass thing they did, but it wouldn't be any more jackassish if that had happened. So anyway, but to your broader point, I suppose that's right. I mean, I'm personally reluctant to jump on the bandwagon of like, let's assume that like people heckling basketball players or football players or whatever is like this awful scourge of society. I think it depends on where you draw the line. And I think that when it gets really personal, or, you know, when there's a, like when it gets racial or like, you know, homophobic or very personal, you know, I can see how that it maybe does feed into this cultural meme that you're talking about, that it's sort of anything goes. I don't really think that we need to like have a morality police that says that, you know, you can't like tell someone like, you know, make some comment about somebody's mom who's a football player. I don't know. Like, I think that's part of the culture that just exists in sports. And I think that's not new. And I don't think that necessarily needs to, I think we need to teach kids. I think we need to crack down on bullying in other spheres and not necessarily there. I think that like our multimillion dollar athletes probably can take it as long as it doesn't. But there is a point where it crosses a line that it's just bad for society as a whole. And how you draw that line is hard to say.
So anyways, let's cut that conversation off there because we could babble about it all night and go into our second topic. Would you like to introduce that one?
Since you second topic.
Oh. Read the article more recently.
Yeah, so there was an article in New York Magazine about a week ago or so.
Oh, longer than that. It's been on for a while.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's gotten over a million hits on the New Yorker website.
All right. Well, the article, the premise of the article is basically...
What's the author's name? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. Why don't you talk about the article a little bit, okay, and I'll try to find out.
Well, I can't really get the premise of the article for you, but it's called All
Joy and No Fun. The author's name is Jennifer Senior.
Jennifer Senior.
It's all Joy and No Fun, and the subtitle is Why Parents Hate Parenting.
All right, Brendan, give us a summary.
All right, so basically, the article sort of summarizes, really, I guess, some scientific literature that's already been out there for a long time and is pretty much regarded, I guess, in the whatever scientific community that studies these things as being basically just legitimate received wisdom. And it is that when you do studies of happiness of people, you find that non-parents are, on the whole, happier than parents, and that people's happiness peaks during the time period when they are either single or married with no kids. And once they have kids, their happiness spikes downward, and then when their kids are in the like 6 to 10 age range, it sort of moves back upwards a little bit, and then when they're adolescents, it like goes way down again, and they hate them their lives, and then once their kids move out of the house, they're happy again, and it basically the whole premise, you know, challenges the sort of very just concrete conventional wisdom among parents that, you know, your kids are the greatest thing that ever happened to you, and that kids, you know, add all this joy to your life and they make everything wonderful and, you know, you would never trade anything for having your kids. And the scientific literature seems to say actually parents are miserable. And so the article looks at that issue and kind of circles around, well, I guess I don't want to give away the ending before we've talked about it a little bit, but it's an interesting, you know, issue. And for me personally, I find myself sort of trying to find a way to rebut it because as a parent of two young kids,
you know, kids under three.
Right. You know, I find myself disagreeing with it viscerally, based on my experience thus far.
But I think that the difference is that you're not sort of the typical guy. We're not the typical couple in a lot of ways. Like, we're not that couple who has a real strong circle of friends who are all single or all without kids, who are sitting here like, oh my gosh, we can't go out with our friends every night because we've got the kids at home. Or you're not like active in some sort of sports league where I'm sitting here at home being like, oh, I can't believe Heath's not home.
Maybe. I don't know how typical that is though. And I'm not.
Well, it's typical around here.
Well, yeah.
I hear a lot of it.
But I guess though, I mean, for me, given what I read in the article, it seemed, you know, and given the fact that it seems to be scientifically well established, I'm going to assume for the sake of argument that they've adjusted for obvious variables like that. And it isn't just, you know, yeah, parents who have a bunch of single friends that are the ones that are miserable. And actually all the parents with other parent friends are super happy.
Oh, yeah.
Presumably they've adjusted for that. So I find myself trying to find a way to explain these findings or rebut them without sort of just dismissing them, poo-pooing them, because I fancy myself someone who thinks science is great. And, you know, this is why I don't like the Tea Party and Sarah Palin and stuff, because I think that, you know, I don't want to let my prejudices and my preconceived beliefs come.
Well, she starts to get to touch on this notion, though, of like, what even is happiness? Right. How do you measure happiness in somebody? Because I think that if you would take a single person on the day-to-day when they're, you know, 35 and have their kids at home and whatever, right. in the thick of it, or versus like someone who's like, you know, 30 without kids or whatever.
Right.
You know, I think that on the day to day, that 30-year-old may in fact be happier.
Right.
But I think when you take like the 70-year-old lady without kids or without, you know, that, and then you take the 70-year-old who's like, well, I've got my grandkids and all this, you know, that, then it's sort of a different story. And
I think that's exactly right. And that's what I found myself sort of internally starting to come around to as I read the article. And then sure enough, at the end of the article, and this is what I was starting to reference earlier, they sort of circled back to that and started to get to that very point in the article itself, that it depends on how you define happiness. And there's sort of, I think, two distinct issues there. One is the sort of, you know, when you look back on your life from a distance removed, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 years later, you know, is happiness what made you happy on the day to day, or is it what gave you fulfillment and purpose at the end of the day when you look back on it? And then there's that. And there's also, I think, that there's happiness, and then there's the depth of your happiness, the depth of the profundity of the joy that you feel. And this is something that I was thinking about, like today in the car, we're driving back from the Rocky Mountains, and Loyacita is Loyette's sound asleep, and Loyacita is wide awake in her car seat, and I'm tickling her, just partly to keep her awake and partly because it's cute. And she's just giggling, and she just looks so happy and so cute and such a charming little giggle. And to anybody other than us, it would just be kind of like passingly cute, like, oh, isn't that sweet? But to us, it's like this, at least to me, it's just like profoundly joyful. It's like there's nothing else in life.
We should see if you can insert sound of her giggling the sound into this, because it really is such a cute giggle.
I think I might be able to. Actually, I think I did get a recording of it. But so here you go, giggle. All right. So anyway, it's such a profound thing, and it's hard to put into words. And I meant to ask you if we could talk about this, and if we can't, I'll cut it out.
No, that's fine.
But you know, we've been talking about, you know, at various times over the last year, let's say, we've talked about
endlessly
the whether we want to have a third kid debate. And without giving away or revealing anything about the outcome, if there is one, of that debate, I'll just say that we've found that it is very difficult to articulate the reasons why you want to have another kid, and very easy to articulate the reasons why it would be a challenge and why you might not want to. It's easy to sit there and say, you know, it would make it hard to go skiing, it would be harder to go to Disney World, it would be harder to do this, we won't have as much time for this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, yeah, parenting can be a real bitch sometimes. You know, in fact, it's like the article says, it's a bitch a lot. There's a lot of really challenging things about it, and we haven't even dealt with anything beyond, you know, 2.5 yet, you know, age-wise. So, you know, there's a lot of challenges. You do give up a lot, and that's another one of the reasons you say, you know, you got two kids, it's pretty easy to find someone to watch them for a while so you can go do something. If you start getting three kids or more, because, you know, getting a babysitter becomes exponentially harder and or more expensive. And so, you know, it just makes everything harder. But at the same time, like, we're both, you know, we've both, you know, find ourselves being incredibly torn about this question, because there is this just inexpressible joy and wonderfulness that comes with having kids. And I was thinking about this, I suppose, on the other point, on the sort of overall fulfillment, looking back on your life, in my mind, I was sort of comparing it to the difference between someone who is really ambitious in their career, and they decide, you know, I want to be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. But in order to do that, I need to, in reality, you probably need to have connections and just, you know, you just sort of land in it. But you're like Lane Kiffin. But supposing, for the sake of argument, that perhaps to get that job, you have to pay your dues. You have to do some really crappy jobs at first, and you have to sort of work your way up and kiss a bunch of ass and really, you know, struggle at first to make a name for yourself so that you can move up and succeed. So those first 5-10 years might suck, but eventually you're working to something great. On the other hand, you have someone who might just get a pretty easy job early in life. They just kind of find this, you know, something they can do, and it's not real challenging, and they're not real ambitious. They just kind of keep doing it, and they don't really care about advancing up the ladder. They're just happy to stay where they are. So that person, you know, might feel on the day to day like, yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't have to work my ass off. I don't have to, you know, if I'm a lawyer, I don't have to bill, you know, 2,300 hours, whatever. But I'm, you know, I'm happy. I'm happy in the day to day. But maybe the other person is the one who, when it's all over, is more fulfilled and has something more to show for it. Which isn't to say that people who don't have kids are like lazy and don't have anything to show for it. I don't mean to say that. But I just think that may be part of what explains this, that, you know, when you're doing a survey of happiness, what are you really asking about? And if you're just asking about day to day, are you happy, you know, were you happy 5 minutes ago? Are you happy 5 minutes from now? That might not really capture the full picture.
I think, wow, that was quite a mouthful of an analogy there, Brendan. I think you were just talking for like 3 minutes straight.
You should have heard me on Melissa's podcast.
I was just starting to fall asleep a little bit over here. I was like, oh my God, it's never going to finish.
Yeah, well, you talk. I'm going to have some more beer.
I've actually been thinking about this in terms of what they were talking about, how, you know, fathers are a little bit happier than mothers and all this. And I'm wondering if there's any studies that show, like, people who've been inculcated with the Protestant work ethic are happier parents, or, you know, how this changes, because the article does reference that, you know, having one child impacts your happiness, but having two or more children seems to drag people down even more. I don't know, probably because they have to work harder, I would think. But, I mean, I wonder how that happens if you've got, like, you know, the families of eight or more, you know, where your older children legitimately are helping you with the childcare responsibilities of the younger children. I don't know if at that point you're just so insane that you don't... You're like, what is happiness after this? I don't know. But I struggle with this article a little bit because I know a lot of people who have had kids in their 30s, mid-30s, and seem to be, like, to feel obligated to have had kids. Like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm married. I should have kids. And then they seem to really miss the life they used to have. The, you know, when I was 30, I would go to work and I would come home and I could do whatever I want and I could go out and drink and do, you know, do whatever I wanted all the time. And I wonder if there's a link in here to sort of an increasing individuality of our society where, you know, what you are is more important than any sort of communal feeling. Because I think especially that this makes sense to me in terms of mothers tending to feel less happy than fathers. Because generally, I think if you would look at these statistics, mothers tend to be the ones who suffer more in their careers for the kids and have less of that individuality left. There's more of the kind of caretaking role, for lack of a better term, that falls on moms. And I wonder if this is something that, you know, that we don't value as a society so much, this caring for other people and nurturing. And, you know, these are things that when you say them out loud, you know, you sit there and you're like, oh, well, you know, the fantastic career of the husband versus the nurturing and caretaking of the wife. You know, we're like, what the fuck is that, right? You know, I mean, honestly, like, you just sit there and even when you speak it out loud, you're like, God, well, that's bullshit. But it's not. You know, there can be something very fulfilling and gratifying and life-affirming in nurturing people. And I just don't think that that's something that as a society, certainly not pop culture wise, that we pay any attention to or pay any homage to.
I think, yeah, I agree with that. I think, like, for me, you know, I think about it in terms of the article cites sort of, you know, the more challenging moments of parenting. And I think we actually can very directly relate because we were just having them tonight.
Gosh.
Where we were trying to get Loyette to
do anything,
and she was just not listening. And we both, in the course of a couple minutes, we both were, you know, yelling pretty loudly at her.
We're not yelling. We don't yell loudly at our child, but we were both like, "Get on the naughty step."
Yeah, that's called yelling.
Yeah, I know, but we're not like up in her face.
Screaming. No,
I don't look at child protective services. We're not like down on our house, Brendan. We're not like screaming at her. We're just, you know,
I think this proves some point. I'm not sure what point, but anyway, your defensiveness about that proves something. No, yeah, but I mean, the point is that we were both like very frustrated with her and trying to maintain our composure and direct that frustration in a way that's, you know, productive, to make her learn something about, you know, how it's important to listen to mommy and daddy. And that's hard. It's hard to get through.
Well, and she's supposed to be refusing to listen. I mean, she's supposed to sort of test that out. How does this work? What happens if I do this? You know, that's very much her age.
Exactly. But it's, you know, but it is definitely a challenge. But at the same time, I think back to a couple weeks ago when I was coming back from my trip to Washington, D.C., where Loya Sita and I went to D.C. together. And obviously, she and I had all kinds of super cute, awesome moments on that trip. But that's not what I'm going to cite. What I'm going to cite is when I came back and I got to the airport and Loyette is in her jammies because my flight was pretty late.
10 o'clock.
Yeah. So she's standing there in the airport in her jammies and Becky's holding her back as I come up the escalator. And finally, I get free enough of the crowd that Becky lets her go. And she just comes running full speed across the airport terminal, like just like a freaking
freight train,
you know, and she just rams into me without slowing down at all. Just rams into me, gives me this huge hug, like hugs my leg, and then I pick her up and she hugs my neck, and she's hugging me as tight as can be for like 2 or 3 minutes, and it was almost like she was like she wouldn't even exhale. She's like, you know, hugs me, and finally she goes, "Daddy, it's so good to see you." And then for the next 20 minutes, all I hear is, "Daddy, I missed you. Daddy, it's so good to see you. Daddy, I'm so glad you're home." And that was so precious. That moment was so precious that it's worth 100,000 nights like tonight. You know, and it really is. And I'm not saying that to be sappy. It really feels that way to me.
Yeah, but it is pretty sappy.
and so, you know, if you say, "Do I have more moments like tonight than that?" Yeah, probably, because she's two, you know. But at the same time, I mean, she's really cute. She's a really adorable two-year-old, and she has a lot of really cute moments. But even so, she's still two. But like, if you were to measure the depth and profoundness of that joy versus the sort of mild, easily forgotten annoyance of her not listening, and a minute later I'm over it because she's two, and I'm gonna hold a grudge, you know. It doesn't even compare at all. The other thing I wanted to say, I found this article as I was Googling the New York Magazine article. I found this blog post from Babbel.com for a new generation of parents. I have no idea what it looks like. It's like a parenting blog. But at the end, they talk about this article. I mean, the whole thing is about the article. But at the end, they say,
"Don't mumble, dude. You're like blah blah blah."
Sorry. Yeah. They say much of the problem with these studies and this broader discussion is obviously semantic. We should really have more words for happiness, fulfillment, pleasure, gratification. None of them really fit the bill. There are dozens of varietals of happiness, and the most sublime among them require a certain amount of sacrifice. The truth is that we get too good at life and we need to be humbled again. We may lose a big chunk of our adult lives to the repetitive maintenance of children." That would be, for example, the trying to get Loya to listen over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
"We may lose time to think novel thoughts and enjoy those of others. We may drink less wine and smell more poop. And we surely spend less time in a serene state of equipoise. But there is a payoff in raw human experience. There's a payoff in raw human experience that is not measured in the studies. A life with incrementally rising average happiness can get stale, predictable. Novelty, not of scenery but of experience, is harder to come by than average happiness, and consequently has more scarcity value. In the trials of parenthood, we are resubmitted to the workaday, stomach-clenching highs and lows of childhood, to the shriek-worthy revelation that is a paper airplane's first launch, or the betrayal of a parent's departure," like when you leave them at daycare or something. "We are damned lucky to have all of this, even if at moments it almost kills us." And I think that pretty much sums up how I feel, which is why I just read two paragraphs of it.
Yeah, for sure. But I do think that there are people who found that, you know, they have these young kids and they feel really trapped by the experience. And I don't want to ignore them in this discussion, because I do think that I know people who really wanted to have kids and suddenly have two kids or three kids and are like, "Oh my goodness, like I'm overwhelmed. I'm exhausted. I don't have time for myself. I don't, you know, it's not fun for them." At that point, it becomes some drudgery. And I worry about that experience of parenthood, that when it doesn't feel like fun anymore. Because I have a lot of fun with our kids. I enjoy them to pieces, and I don't know. I think it would be awful to feel like this isn't fun, and to look at your kids and the experiences of a 2-year-old, which are hilarious because everything is new, and you know, from Loyette taking our sand buckets for our sandbox and putting them on top of the foster dog's crap because she doesn't want it to blow away in the backyard. I mean, this is, if you can't laugh at that and find that funny and amusing and in some senses enjoyable to watch your kid explore their world, even if like it's the dog shit that appeals to them in the world. You know, I think that is profoundly sad to me, that there are these people who really don't enjoy it, you know?
Well, and at the end, there's no, it's hard to find, for those people, I think, to find a support system because you're supposed to enjoy it.
Exactly. That's the thing. Like, it's sort of like this unspoken shame.
Right.
Of, you know, I have these kids and this is supposed to be fun, but I find myself wanting to strangle my child and get them in the bathtub and have them not scream the whole time.
I think we felt a little bit of that with Loyacita when she was younger and she was screaming all the time because she was having a really tough childhood because she had a childhood, a really tough, you know, infanthood. Because she had reflux.
And
it took us a while to kind of figure that out. And so she was just, it was like every day I would come home from work and I was walking around the house for the entire time I was home, holding her and trying to calm her unsuccessfully while she cried because there's nothing else to do. And I was just trying to relieve Becky, who'd been doing that all day. And you just feel so worn down by the whole experience. And yet you feel like you're doing something wrong because you're supposed to be all schmoopy and in love with your little baby, you know.
And at the same time, you're like, can't you just stop crying for 5 minutes?
And I remember when you hosted Bunko. Bunko, we hosted Bunko. Becky's in a Bunko league with her mommy friends, and we hosted it the one time, and somebody was asking me, you know, do you know how many kids do you think you want to have? And I was like, you know, we're not sure, maybe two, maybe three. Sometimes we think one, you know, which is obviously referencing that. But, you know, it's just, it is hard. And so, you know, we've gotten past that point for the most part. But it definitely, I can understand how it would be really hard if you are struggling, with that to, it would be, you know, you'd feel like you're not supposed to say it out loud, you know, because it's like, you're supposed to love your kids unconditionally. And you do. I mean, of course you do. You know, the fact that you might not be on cloud nine all the time, doesn't mean that you don't love your kids unconditionally, but it can feel that way. And that, you know, and there's this, like you said, there's this shame that comes with it.
But I do think that it's not just the temporary thing sometimes. I think that people get into these thought patterns about their kids. Like if they have a kid in a tough stage or a tough time, and then that becomes their definition of their kid, their experience of as a parent, which to me is kind of silly because your kids are constantly changing so quickly that if you don't like, you know, the I'm going to ignore you and see how that goes phase of two, it's going to change in a month. And then there'll be some sort of new horror waiting for us. but you know, I wish that there is, I don't know, some societal recognition of how much it sucks sometimes to just like have to be there all the time, to have kids who wake up at 6:15 every single day, you know, I don't know, like I should get like a free budging pass at the airport or something. Like, you know what? You're not here with like someone who can't wipe their own ass. So I should be able to like budge in front of you in the freaking security line. Just like one person. It would have to be like that douchebag who glares at you if your kid's crying on the airplane.
Yeah, that's a whole, we could do a whole podcast about that.
Yes, we could.
But but instead of doing that, moving on, I think I can move on.
Yeah.
So before we actually go to our next segment, there was something I wanted to mention at the top of the podcast and forgot, and it sort of ties into this whole kid discussion, which is a major event that occurred this evening. As I was putting Loya to bed, I was getting ready to sing her what we call the angel song. It's Billy Joel's Goodnight or Lullaby, Goodnight My Angel, which is her bedtime song every night and has already been designated by me as the father-daughter dance for when she gets married. She said, can you hold me like a little baby, which is how she always asks me to hold her in the first verse. And then she says, I start to sing the angel song and she interrupts me and she says, Daddy, can you sing the USC song?
Aww.
So I sang her the USC song. I sang her the fight song through once, and then for the next verse, I cuddled with her like I always do for the last verse of Goodnight, My Angel, and I sang it through again with the do 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 do. And then that was it. That's all she wanted. And then she went to bed. She didn't. I thought she was going to then say, "Okay, now can you sing me the angel song?" She was just pimping me for an extra song because she has been known to do that. But no, she wanted to hear the USC song instead of the angel song tonight. So whether this is an omen, it means that USC is going to upset Stanford next week or what, I don't know. But I feel like it's a very significant moment.
Yeah, so you heard it here first.
Yeah, exactly. So now for our next and last major segment of this already overlong podcast, I thought it would be kind of a fun experiment to do what for now I'm calling the, what do we call it? The 3 minute who cares spousal conversation challenge. We really need a cashier name. So come up with something, listeners. But anyway, the idea of this is that.
Do you think that anybody's listening at this point? Maybe your dad. Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
So anyway, the idea of this is that each week we'll take turns, one of us coming up with a topic that we're pretty sure the other one won't care about at all. And we have to try to talk about it for 3 minutes, a two-way conversation.
This is so much easier for him because all he has to do is talk about college football.
But I'm not going to this week. I'm not going to. I'm going to save that for a later podcast. So anyway, I'm going to do this week's, and then we have a little alarm that'll go off when we hit 3 minutes. So this my topic this week is Connecticut politics.
Oh, okay.
So
do share.
So Richard Blumenthal has been the Attorney General of the state of Connecticut for pretty much my entire life. And I mean, literally, he's been there for like 20, 22 years or something like that, 18 years, 22 years, like pretty much most of the time that I've been alive. And
I think Connecticut have like a queen or something.
So Blumenthal, every freaking election for governor or senator, everyone's waiting to see if Blumenthal will jump into the race. He's known to be ambitious, but he's just been biding his time. It's like in Pirates of the Caribbean, waiting for the opportune moment. He's been biding his time, and he's gotten to the point where everyone thinks he's a winner.
So, am I actually going to be able to interject into this three minutes?
Yes. So anyway, Blumenthal finally, when Dodd retired, Blumenthal decided to jump into the race, and it looked like he was a totally sure bet to win the Senate seat because, you know, he's so popular in Connecticut. Well, now because the Democrats are doing so terribly across the country, plus his opponent has a ton of money, she's catching up to him in the polls, and it's looking really close. And now Connecticut has become a target state for the Republicans. And I just think it would be like the great political irony and sort of hilarious and sad if after all that, after 20-some years, he ends up losing and what he thought was his final sure bet to get into the Senate because he happened to run in the year when everyone hates Democrats. So there you go, Richard Blumenthal. What are your thoughts, Becky?
Well, I think that would sure be a pity, Brendan, if Mr. Blumenthal lost. But actually worse than that, I think is that, you know, Democrats have this sort of entitlement in certain states that they feel like we just will win. You know, like, why do we even have to try in Connecticut? We'll just win.
It's not the Kennedy seat, it's the people seat.
You know, but
Scott Brown rallying cry.
Yeah, and I think that that's, like, that sort of, I don't know, like, high-handedness is something I hate in Democrats. But, I mean, you should certainly see the same thing in sort of, like, a Republican in Oklahoma. But, I mean, you know, that, like, you politicians, listen up, all right? You don't freaking own these seats because you have a freaking tent or, what the hell is this, an elephant or a donkey, you know? Like, they belong to the people, and we can take them away from any political party we want to if you guys are fucking up, which, frankly, y'all are. So I think that that's what Blumenthal needs to hear, is that this is not his entitlement. It's not something that he's earned by virtue of his hard work for the state of Connecticut. No, like, you're not entitled. This is not like a jewel for your crown. You know, this is a representative democracy where you have to earn it by shaking hands and actually promising to do something good for the people. And maybe that isn't just sitting and bowing down and kissing the establishment's ass. Or, you know, being like, hello, I will carry Dodd's corrupt torch to whoever, you know, wherever I need to carry it. So I hope Blumenthal wins, but I don't think that kind of, that's not a very effective campaign slogan.
Yay! I didn't even get to respond. All right.
See?
You went on a good rant there.
Yeah.
I guess that's pretty much it. We were going to do some sort of a segment where we look forward to the next week. I actually have nothing to say on the segment. I haven't really thought about it.
Oh my gosh. Well, so I'm going to be super busy next week. I have a book club starting up, so if people have book suggestions, this is how I'll know if anybody's actually listening. we're having our inaugural book club meeting, we're getting our piano tuned. We're buying a new tree for our yard, so I'm thinking that I'm going to tell... It's the Liberty Tree.
Beep.
What? Oh, crap. I'm going to tell Loyette that it's the Liberty Tree because she's obsessed with the Liberty Tree song, which I'm sure Brendan can link to this podcast for all those who are dying of curiosity.
We'll play it on the fade out from the podcast. Yeah. Part of it anyway.
I don't know. I work this weekend, so, you know. Yay. No, maybe I don't work. No, I work this weekend. Never mind.
Do we have a date night coming up?
At the end of October. It's the day before your birthday.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I don't know what I'm looking forward to this week. I'm going to be busy at work, which I can't talk about in the podcast.
You can talk about how you're busy at work. You're just not going to be like, and so-and-so is suing so-and-so, yuck, yuck, because you're not a dork.
Yeah. And
you're going to get fired.
I'm looking forward to USC losing to Stanford. No, I'm not.
No, you know what he's looking forward to is the meatloaf I'm cooking for dinner.
Yeah, there you go. There
meatloaf
you go.
And mashed potatoes is his favorite meal.
Yeah, that's true. There you go. That's an excellent thing that I'm looking forward to. I didn't know I was looking forward to it. Now I know that I'm looking forward
to
it.
And that's what your wife does for you. So yeah. I inspire and encourage you. So as a way of signing off, our friends Travis and McKenna just got married last night.
Yeah.
And they had wonderful vows, and one of their vows was that they will encourage and inspire each other. So here's to you, our audience, our dedicated, devoted audience still listening at this point.
After 50 minutes.
Yeah. I hope that we encourage and inspire you to do great things this week.
Thank you for listening, and we'll leave you with a selection from the Liberty Tree.
Pay the price they're asking for, always pay the tyrant's fee. Never give up the struggle, boys, fight for the Liberty Tree. It's a tall old tree and a strong old tree. And we are the sons, yes, we are the sons of liberty. Stand for the rights of man, boys, stand against all tyranny. Hang the lance of freedom, boys. We are the sons, yes, we are the sons of liberty.